Be seated.
Good morning.
Welcome to your third court of appeals, where we are doing our best to keep the lights on, keep everything moving along. We have two cases this morning. We'll go ahead and call for ready announcements from the attorneys. First case is going to be Southern California Sunbelt Developers versus Grammar. Morning, Ms. Murray.
Good morning, Your Honor. John Bellow, for the appellees.
Good morning, sir. All those parties and just two lawyers, y'all must really be good. All right. Very good morning, Mr. Chu. And then our second case is going to be CEC Entertainment versus Hager.
Matthew Kennedy for the comptroller.
Morning, Mr. Kennedy. Very well. I heard Mr. Siegel is going to take a stroll for a while, so we'll forgive his absence. For those of you new to the third court, each side will be allocated 20 minutes to argue. You should have already coordinated with the clerk as far as how you want to split that time up in terms of reserving. I believe 5 minutes for appellant's rebuttal is the standard. We have time warning system. When the yellow light comes on, that means you have 2 minutes remaining. When the red light comes on, your time has expired and you need to look to the court to continue. By way of housekeeping, if anybody in the audience has a cell phone, pager, or other device, now would be a good time to turn that off so that we don't disturb our litigants. Also, we now have an audio recording system, and so the arguments will be recorded by audio and put up on the website within 24 hours for your future use. With regard to that website, I'll go ahead and give a formal call of the case so that we have the cause number. Southern California Sunbelt Developers versus Grammar, cause number 19-192-CV. And with that, we are ready. Ms. Murray, when you are.
May it please the court.
Yes, ma'am.
Rule 91A was promulgated to provide for early dismissal of causes of action having no basis in law or fact, and in order to make the civil justice system more efficient, less costly, and more accessible. None of that happened in this case. In the trial court, SCSD and Bayer sought to enforce two November 2014 cost awards of about $40,000 each in the principal amount, which were made by California trial court in what we call in our briefing the Van Dan lawsuit. The cost awards were charged jointly and severally against two Grammar Nevada Limited partnerships, Banyan and Orange Blossom, and once quantified became part of the Van Dan judgment under California law.
So there is a judgment as to those amounts?
Yes, they, under California procedural law, it's different than in Texas, but the cost awards are decided after the judgment, but then are become part of the judgment pursuant to California Rule of Court 3.1700.
And so, was that judgment domesticated here in Texas?
No, Your Honor, it was not.
Okay.
SCSD and Bayer sought payment of the cost awards from the limited partnership general partners, which at various times were members of the Grammar family or other entities. The ability of SCSD and Bayer to enforce these cost awards was made more difficult by the fact that the general partner kept changing and by the fact that the Grammars transferred substantially all of their assets to Grammar entities, which then became their personal checkbooks. It was because of that that SCSD and Bayer sought to recover those fraudulent transfers from the transferees pursuant to the Texas Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. In this Rule 91A order, the trial court was very specific about its rationale. It cited two Nevada Limited Partnerships statutes and Section 541 of the Bankruptcy Code. The trial court found that SCSD and Bayer's causes of action seeking to enforce their own cost awards against the Grammars became property of the bankruptcy estates and upon filing of the Banyan and Orange Blossom bankruptcy cases, and were under the sole control of the Chapter 7 trustee, and that permitting SCSD and Bayer to enforce those causes of action or pursue those causes of action in a Texas court would impermissibly interfere with the trustee's ability to marshal assets of the bankruptcy estate and make ratable distributions to the creditors.
Wasn't there a point at which the trial judge had that knowledge, though, before he signed the actual order?
Had what knowledge?
Had the knowledge that the bankruptcy had I guess, resolved or gone away?
Yes. That is...
How do we treat that as far as assuming what the trial judge's logic was in granting this?
Well, our position, of course, is that once the bankruptcy cases were dismissed, there was no property of the estate, there was no automatic stay, there was no trustee, and we apprised the trial court of that before the trial court entered the order on the attorney's fees and completed the Rule 91A proceedings, but the trial court would not reconsider the dismissal part of his ruling. So the only rationale for the ruling was no longer existed, and yet the trial court would not reconsider its ruling. As a result, then, of course, we're here today on appeal trying to correct the error of the trial court.
In your briefing, you say that the bankruptcy trustee had knowledge of these claims?
Yes.
How so?
Just through various communications and efforts to try to see if there was any way in which we could make clear to the trial court that this was not an issue. But the trustee of the bankruptcy cases never pursued these claims, never. Most importantly, I guess, the trustee of the bankruptcy cases never took the position that the causes of action being pursued in Texas were in any way a violation of the automatic stay, which would have been the result had they actually been property of the estate. So, or had they actually interfered with property of the estate. And the fact that there was never any stay violation alleged or adjudicated in the bankruptcy cases is significant. It completely undercuts any kind of an analysis that says that these claims, or even the right to pursue these claims against the general partners, were property of the bankruptcy estate.
So, Ms. Murray, these claims were not adjudicated in bankruptcy, correct?
No, they weren't even brought against the debtors. They were brought, or the property of the debtors. They were brought against the general partners of the debtors, against the general partner's property, which is not property of the estate. The definition of property of the estate, as we point out in our brief, and as the trial court refers to Section 541A of the Bankruptcy Code, is all legal or equitable interests of the debtor in property as of the commencement of the case. And we were suing the Grammers, who were the general partners, and the Grammers are the Grammer family plus the Grammer entities, all of the different entities that are the defendants in the case below. But they were not debtors. Other entities of the Grammer family, the Banyan and Orange Blossom, were the debtors. And they were the judgment debtors as well. Now, the two Nevada limited partner statutes that were cited by the trial court, the Grammers have conceded that Section 87A5.30 doesn't apply. So unless the court has questions about that, I'm not going to spend any time on it. The other statute that was cited by the trial court was 87A.365. And of course, the trial court is reasoning that as of the commencement of the case, the debtors had the power to compel the general partner to pay the debts of the limited partnership. But of course, Section 365 doesn't say that. All it says is the general principle of law that general partners are liable jointly and severally for all obligations of the limited partnership unless otherwise agreed by the claimant or provided by law. That statute, therefore, doesn't really support the trial court's analysis. And if we look to 365, we see that far from defeating SCSD and Bayer's right to bring the causes of action that they brought, it confirms that they had a right to do that, that they had a right to seek payment from the general partners of the debtors. And in this vein, you know, it's important that the trial court did not consider Section 370 of the Nevada Limited Partnership Law, because that statute actually further undercuts the trial court's rationale. It provides that a judgment creditor of a general partner may levy execution against the assets of the general partner to satisfy a judgment based on a claim against the limited partnership if the partner is personally liable for the claim under Section 365 and the limited partnership is a debtor in bankruptcy. So the statute, under the Nevada statute, contemplates the situation that we had here where the debtor, where the limited partnership was a debtor in bankruptcy. We had a right to go against the general partner. Now, the caveat is that you have to have a judgment against the general partner as well, and that was the judgment we were seeking in Blanco County. And by dismissing Bear and SESD's cause of action, the court was actually depriving them of the right to pursue the remedy that Nevada limited partnership law provides for people in the situation.
What is, remind me what our standard of review is on one of these Rule 91As. And then also, is it like a summary judgment where we uphold it if there's any reasoning or rationale that would have justified the granting of it?
Two questions. The standard of review is de novo. The Supreme Court has likened this to questions of law. To, you know, the determination of whether a remedy is available on the facts pled is a question of law. And that the factual plausibility of a petition is also reviewed as a question of law. And so they've determined that a 91A standard of review is de novo. As far as, the second part of your question,
was essentially, will it stand up if there's any reason or rationale for it aside from the ones that were stated?
There's certainly, even this court in its jurisprudence has made clear that if the order coming out of the Rule 91A proceeding does not specify the grounds on which it was granted, then yes, every single possible theory raised in the 91A motion must be addressed, kind of like the summary judgment. And practices, But that didn't happen here. In this case, there were primarily two categories of arguments made in the Rule 91A motion, those that I'm talking about now having to do with the Nevada partnership law and having to do with bankruptcy law. And then there were these other affirmative defense arguments, which were based on affirmative defenses that were never pled and therefore were waived, and for which the movements attached exhibits to their Rule 91A motion in an effort to have the court rule on things that had never been pled. So I think the trial court in its ruling decided to focus on the Nevada limited partnership law part and the bankruptcy part and not address and did not address any of the affirmative defenses.
Well, and under 91A, we're bound by what's in the pleadings. We don't look at anything attached. Isn't that correct?
Under Rule 91A.6, the trial court is not supposed to consider any evidence. It's only supposed to look at the pleadings.
Correct.
And they're primarily, unless on the face of the petition, a plaintiff essentially pleads itself out of court, pleads dates, for example, that prove that limitations have passed and has not pled any tolling theories. So it's really the plaintiff's petition that's at issue and the analysis of the plaintiff's petition without consideration of any evidence and without consideration of any affirmative defenses and certainly not any unpled affirmative defenses.
Can I ask you a question, go somewhere else? So. What evidence do y'all have, or I shouldn't say evidence, on your pleadings, where do you support? I know that there is an argument for Donald Gramer and the son, and y'all are pleading collectively the wife and the daughter. Can y'all survive 91A challenge if there's not a whole lot, or can you point me to where in the petition y'all are claiming what their acts were?
I think that the problem and the reason that there are so many defendants joined in the case below is that we had evidence of an accountant expert indicating that the assets of the Grammers and the people that we could identify as general partners listed in Secretary of State filings in Nevada, those assets had been transferred to other entities, and it was not entirely clear to whom they had transferred all of these assets, but this accountant had made a report, an extensive report, that these assets were being transferred in a huge shell game. And so all of those people were joined, subject to discovery, subject to amendment, none of which we got to do. But the, you know, in an abundance of caution, all of the people who were in that expert report from prior litigation were joined to be sure that we had before the court, had timely sued before the court, all those who might be subject, subject to the transfer of Texas Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, which of course allows you to recover the transfer from the transferee. And not just, it's not just against the transferor, it's the transferee who's actually holding the property who then has to return it. If it was the transfer was fraudulent, either intentionally or constructively. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
It does.
My recollection, I just don't have that information in front of me here, Your Honor, is that Darrellyn Grammer was at one point a general partner of one of the entities, but I may be wrong on that, so I don't want to speculate. If the court needs me to, I'd be happy to provide a post-submission letter on that. One of the theories that is articulated by the Grammers is that, and in the trial court's order as well, is that SCSD and Bear did not have the authority to bring the claims that they were bringing was actually the authority of the bankruptcy trustee. And they rely on Section 723A of the Bankruptcy Code. The Grammers even go so far to argue as that a cause, oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead and finish your thought. That's fine.
That a cause of action under 723A is property of the estate, and of course it is not, because it doesn't meet the definition of property of the estate. It wasn't a legal or equitable interest of the debtor in property as of the commencement of the case.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. That's the first time I've let anyone continue when they were talking about the bankruptcy code. Morning, sir.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, John Beliveau for Don Grammer, his family, and all of the entities sued in this case. A party without standing can't sue, and its claims need to be dismissed. The claims in this suit were based on two cost awards that returned against two limited partnerships which were in bankruptcy, and because of that bankruptcy, they were not sued. Instead, suit was brought against the general partner of those two limited partnerships, an entity called Apple Management Services, one of the defendants in this case, against the Grammers individually, and against every entity in which they've ever had an interest, apparently. They claim the general partner is liable as the general partner of the limited partnerships and has to pay these cost awards, and due to a conspiracy they claim exists, but which is unsupported by anything in the record, everyone else is also. However, because of the bankruptcy, these claims belonged to the bankruptcy estate. They were subject to the control of the bankruptcy trustee, and the appellants have no standing to bring the claims in this case, and they were properly dismissed. Now, under Rule 91A, claims can be dismissed because they lack a basis in law or a basis in fact. And concentrating on nothing but the first amended petition, which was the pleading that was determinative in this case, both of those circumstances exist. Your Honor, Justice Strano, your question was, how are the wife and the daughter and many of these entities connected? And the answer is, based on the pleadings, we have no idea. They're collectively referred to as defendants. Defendants did this bad stuff, and there are those allegations, but we have no factual basis for any of those. An accountant's report, not seen it. There's also, the petition also shows the legal problem, the lack of standing, to which I referred to earlier. In it, the appellants plead the existence of these cost awards, the bankruptcies of the limited partnerships against which they're returned, that they're seeking to recover from the general partner because the general partner is liable for the limited partnership's obligations, debts, and that everyone else should be made to pay also. In bankruptcy, any claim that a debtor can make is property of the estate. Future, contingent, speculative, derivative, uncertain, unliquidated, if there is any circumstance under which a debtor can bring a claim, it is property of the estate, and it's subject to the control of the trustee. Appellants argue, well, wait a minute, these cost awards were returned to us. They're our property. They're judgments that we can enforce. We can try and collect these. That may be true, but it's also true that the limited partnerships can recover from the general partner to help pay the debts that the limited partnership has incurred. And because of that, they are property of the estate. And because they're claims of the estate, no one can assert them but the trustee until the bankruptcy is completed, administered, or the claim is formally abandoned by the trustee, which requires a filing with the bankruptcy court, and there's no evidence that that was ever done here. There's an overarching problem with the claims the appellants make in this case. In the trial court, in their argument, in their brief, they say, we have standing to assert the claims that we have asserted. And they have to say that, because if there's no standing, they don't have jurisdiction, and if they don't have jurisdiction, they can't be in court. And yet at the same time, they argue that none of the mechanisms for asserting a claim against a general partner to recover on its liability for what the limited partner did or owes apply. Nevada law doesn't apply. The bankruptcy code doesn't apply. So, and again, I understand that they have to take that position, because if any of those laws do apply and the limited partnership can pursue the general partner and collect on these obligations and get the general partner to pay on its behalf, on their behalf, for the obligations, for the cost awards, then they're part of the estate, and there's no standing. And yet the claims they bring in this case seek to do exactly what we say you can do under Nevada law and what could potentially be done under bankruptcy law. That is, make the general partner pony up the money to pay the debts owed by the limited partnerships, to discharge the debts owed by the limited partnerships to one creditor, or two creditors, I suppose, in this case, to the detriment of all of the others. Instead of having that money collected from the general partner, from the Grammers, from whatever entities they end up proving might be obligated to pay, that money should go into the bankruptcy estate and be available to be distributed under the bankruptcy code to all of the various creditors in accordance with the priorities and hierarchy set out in the bankruptcy code.
The record seems to be not exactly full or complete as to what the status of the bankruptcy is. I mean, where do we stand?
The 91A motion was made. It was granted, and the claims were dismissed. At some point afterwards, the bankruptcy in Nevada was apparently dismissed, and we know this only because the appellants came in their first supplement to the second amended motion to reconsider, filed immediately before the hearing on the motion to reconsider, attached some documents indicating that that's the case. I will say I had no involvement with the bankruptcy or any of the proceedings outside of the state of Texas, or indeed this proceeding, until I was retained to handle the appeal after their appellant's brief was filed. Beyond that document, I can't answer your question. It seems to have been dismissed.
So for purposes of our record, though, we don't know if it's still in process or whether it's been dismissed.
Or what? And in any case, the property would have been part of the estate until that dismissal, and jurisdiction's determined when you file the case.
But if it has been dismissed, then this claim, unless, you know, and I don't do bankruptcy, I'm not in that court, explain to me, assuming that it's been dismissed, then how would these claims be part of the estate if there's no bankruptcy estate right now?
It would depend on the nature of the disposition of the bankruptcy case. Bankruptcy judgments and bankruptcy dispositions, the administration of an estate, can be ultimately res judicata on claims. It can be a final judgment on entitlement to claims and so forth. If a debtor goes into bankruptcy and a creditor is informed of that and you need to make a claim, if you have a claim against this debtor and the creditor doesn't file the proof of claim, there is no claim at that point. It's over and done with. It would depend on if you have a bankruptcy Chapter 11 or Chapter 13 where there's a plan, the treatment of the claim within the plan is going to determine the ultimate outcome, who's liable for it, who owes what, when. The answer is it depends on the nature of the disposition of the bankruptcy, which we don't know.
So you don't agree that our record contains that it's been dismissed?
I agree that the record contains documents indicating that it's been dismissed, but the nature of the dismissal and what relief was granted in connection with that, we have no idea. The documents were, I believe, single-page documents indicating the existence of the dismissal. been a lot of talk about the statute that the trial court relied on in disposing of the case. It's Nevada Revised Statutes 87A365, and 87A365 says that general partners are liable for the debts of the limited partnership. The complaint was made, well, there's no mechanism in the statute for enforcing this claim. And my response to that is very simple. There is a mechanism. It's a statute. When you have a statutory right and it's not being honored, when an obligation is not being met, you sue to enforce it. They're suing to enforce a right here. If you look at the equivalent provision in the Texas Business Organizations Code, 153-152, it says general, and I'm paraphrasing here, general partners are liable for limited partnership debts, and there's no mechanism for enforcing that. Does that mean it can't be enforced? No. And if the answer is it can be enforced by the limited partnership, then back to the basic situation here, that the claim is part of the estate, the bankruptcy estate. It belongs to the trustee. It's the trustees to determine what to do with, and the appellants have no standing to bring their claim. 87A370, which counsel also addressed here in her argument, talks about a judgment creditor of a general partner trying to levy execution against the assets of the general partner to satisfy a claim against the limited partnership. It doesn't apply here. They're not yet a judgment creditor of the general partner. They're not levying an execution. They made a lot of claims in their petition, a lot of different claims. That we're executing on them is not one of them. And in fact, because these cost awards were never domesticated, I don't think you can. I do not think you could have a writ of execution issued on a foreign judgment that's not yet been domesticated and turned into a Texas trial court judgment. There's also been some discussion about the evidence that should be considered in connection with a 91A motion, and it's pointed out that 91A6 says, generally speaking, you don't look at evidence. There's an exception for documents that are attached to the petition that are permissible under the rules. But generally, you don't. I would observe that this is an issue on which the appellants have been bouncing around all over the place, one side and the other. We have evidence that shows that we have standing or that we can pursue these claims. Look at it. You can't look at the evidence. You can't dismiss it based on what the evidence shows. They filed no less than 8 documents in the trial court. 8. Making their arguments about standing, making their arguments against dismissal of the case. 5 of them had evidence attached. The evidence attached totaled almost 300 pages of evidence, limited partnership agreements, affidavits, documents from these prior proceedings, documents from the bankruptcy court, et cetera, things that we wouldn't know but for the evidence. I think that you can uphold the 91A dismissal based on the pleading alone without considering any of the evidence. But if there's any evidence to be looked at, I think that evidence would also support the same conclusion that there is no standing and therefore no jurisdiction here. This court decides cases all the time on 2 documents, 91A motion and the response, plea and the response, TCPA motion and the response. Sometimes there are 3, a motion, response, reply. 8 documents, all making different iterations of the same argument, 5 of them supported by evidence, 2 hearings before the court. 91A motion without evidence based on their pleadings, a plea, a summary judgment, however you would want to characterize it, on the lack of standing, which results in the dismissal of this, should result in the dismissal of this suit. And finally, there's a question that wasn't raised by the appellants. I don't want to let it go unspoken, though, is the attorney's fee award. Roar Moose Ventures has, I think, probably resulted in a lot more points of error on attorney's fees in this court. I'd be surprised if it were otherwise. But Justice Triana, you sat on a trial bench. You sat on, I think, 3 different trial benches. And I can't imagine that you ever walked off that trial bench and said, you know what that trial needed? That trial needed more testimony, another couple of hours on attorney's fees. Right. Justice Smith, you were in practice. I doubt you ever made the announcement, Your Honor, we're here, we're ready for trial. We announced 3 days on the breach of contract claim and a day and a half on the attorney's fees. The attorney's fee award is sufficient if you show that the fees charged were reasonable, which has 2 elements. The hourly rate charged was reasonable and the total amount charged was reasonable. And the things you did to fill those hours of time that you're seeking compensation for were necessary. And the evidence here, I'm not going to run through the argument in any great detail, but we had three lawyers in this case, minimum experience of 35 years. They charged $300 an hour, a very reasonable rate for what they were doing. They explained how they spent their time, what they spent their time on, and why they had to spend their time on it, and then analyzed that through the Arthur Anderson factors. There was not a request that the amount be increased because of superlative work or anything like that. It really is just reward us for the hours that we spent, and we're only asking for the hours that we spent in connection with this motion. Returning to Wormus, if that's not enough, lawyers are going to have to begin with what I'm going to call a Wormus apology before they start on attorney's fees.
What is the word you're saying?
Wormus.
Wormus.
Wormus, R-O-H-R-M-O-O-S, venture. It's okay. The Supreme Court's most recent pronouncement on attorney's fees. The Wormus apology. Your Honor, I know you heard the entire case and you've been a judge for 20 years, but I'm sorry, we're going to have to spend about 5 or 6 hours running through everything we did on this case so our attorney's fee recovery won't be reversed on appeal. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm sorry, you're going to get a master class in incurring attorney's fees and what's recoverable. They're going to have to begin with that apology. But that's not the case. If you look at Wormus Venture itself, at the very end of the discussion of how you prove attorney's fees, what you need to do, the court says this: we are not endorsing satellite litigation as to attorney's fees. The fact finder will generally not benefit from attorneys cross-examining each other point by point on every billable matter. And that's certainly the truth. It ends by saying parties should use discovery and pretrial procedure to evaluate attorney's fee claims and the evidence supporting them, and then present to the trier of fact the evidence relevant for determining the reasonable and necessary fee. You can go back and look at the cross-examination that was done of the attorneys who were testifying about the fees. All the involved testified, and that opportunity was not taken. The evidence in support of the fees sought is more than sufficient. Finally, before concluding, I want to address a question that Chief Justice Rose asked during appellant's counsel argument about on what can you affirm? Can you affirm based on something other than the grounds laid out in the order granting the dismissal? I think you should affirm on the grounds laid out in the order granting the dismissal. But I also believe that it's like a summary judgment motion. If a litigant moves for summary judgment on grounds A, B, and C, trial court says, I'm granting summary judgment on ground A, and is silent on B, and is silent on C, and it goes up on appeal. And this court finds that, no, you can't have summary judgment on ground A, that's not proper. Because it's de novo review, and because you as judges are able to apply the law as any other judges in this state, you could affirm on ground B, you could affirm on ground C, if you find that that's supported by the record, supported by the law. It is a de novo issue, and if you don't like the conclusion that was reached by the trial court, if the record allows you to reach a contrary one, I believe you may do that. A party that doesn't have standing can't sue, and its case must be dismissed. Any effort to collect the amounts due on the fee awards that were returned against the bankrupt limited partners from the general partner or from others are claims that the limited partners could assert, and therefore, because they could assert it, they are part of their bankruptcy estate. They're controlled by the bankruptcy trustee. They can't be brought by the appellants. And the trial court's answer, the trial court's conclusion in this case, was correct. Determination that the appellants lack standing to sue ought to be affirmed.
Can I go back to the bankruptcy? You're saying that these claims belong to the bankruptcy estate. Isn't there times where the bankruptcy estate will have concurrent jurisdiction with the state court, depending on what the asset is?
Yes, still subject to the control of the trustee. For example, if a debtor in bankruptcy goes into bankruptcy and has a personal injury claim, unrelated to the bankruptcy, they just happen to have been involved in a car accident. That claim is an asset of the estate. It could be turned into money that would belong to the debtor and would then be available to distribute to the creditors of that debtor. The trustee in that situation would go to the court and seek court permission to hire counsel to litigate the personal injury claim, and they could certainly do that in state court. In fact, they will typically do it in state court. The bankruptcy judges don't want to be trying a Texas personal injury case in their court. The matter will be sent off to Texas state court to be resolved, and if it turns into a judgment for the debtor, the money will be paid into the estate and will then be available to the trustee to distribute among the various creditors. So the concurrent jurisdiction does exist in certain cases, but the control over the estate is vested entirely in the trustee and can be protected by the bankruptcy court if necessary.
Thank you.
Did I answer? Okay.
Yeah.
I know how bankruptcy is. So, and if there are no more questions, that's all
thank
I
you,
have.
Mr. Belleville.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Rebuttal, Ms. Miller.
Just to make sure the record is clear, the in our briefing, our opening brief on page 12, we tell the court that on May 24, 2018, the trustee filed his final report stating that the bankruptcy estates had been fully administered and abandoning all scheduled and known assets that had not been administered in the jointly administered bankruptcy cases. That's clerk's record 572-299. And on September 5th, 2018, the trustee filed his final report and account and distribution report, or his final account, in which he certified that all assets and funds which had come under his control in the case had been properly accounted for as provided by law, and he applied to be discharged. So the things that they purported claims that were abandoned certainly included anything that the trustee might have thought he had pursuant to the sort of argument that Mr. Belleville has just made. All of that is in the record and in our briefing. I want to address the standing issue because that is an issue that was really not pled, it was not argued, and now it's showing up in the briefing. And of course, I'm well aware that it cannot be waived, but standing is not the issue in this case. These cost awards were cost awards of SCSD and Bayer against the debtors. They were liabilities of the bankruptcy estate, if anything, not assets of the bankruptcy estate. These were our claims that we were asserting against the debtors, but we could enforce under Nevada law and under Texas law, enforce against the general partners because the limited partnerships were debtors in bankruptcy. And we were the ones who were aggrieved. We were the ones who had an interest in the outcome of the case here in Texas. We were the ones whose rights would be redressable by that litigation. Those are the tests under Nuzzi, for example, for standing, under Heckman for standing, and certainly SCSD and Bayer had standing to bring the claims they had. They had the authority under Nevada law. And as far as the civil practice, or as far as whether they needed to domesticate the judgment or not, the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code provides under section 35.008 that they had the right, SCSD and Bayer had the right to pursue the claims that they pursued in litigation as opposed to domesticating the judgment. They had the alternative they chose to pursue in litigation, in part because they needed that judgment against the general partner. There's a lot of confusion about what bankruptcy does and doesn't do in this case, and what property the estate is and is not. I tried to lay that out very thoroughly in my briefing, and in a minute and 42 seconds, I can't recreate all of that. But I want to go back to section 723, because that seemed to be the thrust of the argument being made by the Grammers in the trial court. Section 723, for any number of reasons, doesn't work the way they think it does. A claim under 723 is not property of the estate because it is not the interest of the debtor in property as of the commencement of the case. It's a federal cause of action that the trustee is allowed to bring when there's a deficiency in the amount of assets available to pay all of the creditors of the bankruptcy estate. In this case, a deficiency was never alleged in a motion. It was not part of our pleadings. The trial court never dealt with it. And even if there had been a deficiency, that would have been a disputed fact issue, an allegation of deficiency. That would have raised a disputed fact issue that's not at all suitable for Rule 91A determination. As far as whether we have to, I think we already talked about this a little bit, but we do not have to address every issue raised by the Rule 91A motion, but we did. In Parkhurst, this is 481 Southwest 3rd, 400. The court states the rule as I understand it to be true for Texas, which is that when the party, when the trial court does not say the grounds for which the relief under Rule 91A is granted, then it is the burden of the person challenging that order to discuss all possible grounds. But in this case, the trial court was very clear. We ask you to
I didn't hear. In this case, the trial court.
In this case, the trial court was very clear about its rationale. And with that, we ask the court to reverse the trial court's Rule 91A order and the Rule 91A-7 order granting attorney's fees.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Mr. Bellevue, for a case well argued. The case will be submitted and you all can be excused. We are going to take a brief break for a panel change, and the folks in the next case can feel free to come on up front.